Hey everybody, welcome to Skeleton Keys.
I'm Tori Aitzor.
And I'm John Booker.
And together we're going to try to unlock the mysteries of mythology and history in pop culture. And I am excited today because we are talking about something that is such a broad topic, but I think everybody can kind of relate to. We're talking about beauty standards.
Tori, you know, when we first brought this idea up, you know, I thought, oh, how does that relate to history, mythology, pop culture, the things we deal with on this podcast? And then my mind was flooded with like 3,000 different stories and ideas and myths. And I was almost embarrassed because there are so many things in so many intersections where mythology, history, and pop culture intersect with this idea of beauty standards. What about you? Where did it hit initially for you when we came up with this idea?
What it hit initially for me and just kind of examining how as beauty standards change, you can see the society that it's in change.
Yeah.
It can be classist beauty standards, or it could be the, as we're seeing now, the kind of multiculturalism of our world is dictating the beauty standards. Or it could be how colonization changes the beauty standards. So that was kind of how, when we brought it up, I was like, well, what does that have to do with history? And then I realized it has everything to do with history and that it's in so many facets of it. And that got me really excited to talk about it.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to date myself just a bit here, but I remember studying in college when so many of the communication courses, you know, that I took would talk about societal standards and beauty standards. And the example there was always the magazines you'd see on the rack, like when you were checking out in the grocery store. And, you know, especially the images of women, you know, on these magazines and how these women were airbrushed and nobody actually looked like that in real life. And, you know, this was a big topic of discussion. Well, of course, since that time, you know, the magazine industry has fallen apart in many ways. But I would say, you know, the idea of the beauty standards that were often, you know, communicated through those magazines have not gone anywhere. We've just replaced them with Instagram filters and, you know, different ways that we touch ourselves up to make our image and the image of other people something that is an amplified version of reality, or at least an edited version of reality.
100%. And in a way, because I come from the time of magazines being the kind of what you looked for, the touchstone in terms of beauty. But in a way, now with Instagram and social media, you're inundated with images of beauty all the time. So it becomes, in my head, oh, well, that's what people look like. When in actuality, that's not what any of us look like. Those are filters and contours and everything that we can use to change our appearance. But I think because of the prevalence of it in our lives, like we can just open our phone and then there's an image of what is considered beautiful. It can become overwhelming. And so I think you're seeing a lot of people, beauty's on everyone's mind because we're just overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we're living in a really interesting time because there has been a lot of discussion about beauty standards, and we've seen some brands, for example, advertise commercials with men and women that don't fit, you know, the more classic traditional beauty standards. There's been a lot of celebration of what we might call non-traditional beauty standards, and especially as ideas of gender become more fluid, and the ideas of masculinity and femininity and the absence of those things and the presence of those things in all people, you know, this discussion of beauty standards has gotten a lot more nuanced. It's gotten a lot more complex in a beautiful and wonderful way. And we've seen that, you know, demonstrated in pop culture. But I would still dare to say there, even despite all of our progress when it comes to these progressive ideas of beauty standards, we still, I think, in great numbers see people gravitate towards the beauty standards that have been most common in the United States for the last 100, 150 years. But I do think it's important to recognize that beauty standards ebb and flow and they change. Anytime, you know, that we look at mythology, we look at the paintings of previous centuries, and you look at especially the female beauty standards of the time being much more robust women, much more shapely women than we would see in our modern times. And that was the height, you know, of beauty. How about you? What do you think of when you think about, you know, history and beauty standards, especially, you know, as we talk about maybe marginalized people or people of color that have not always had a platform for amplifying beauty standards within their own communities?
I think it's interesting, you know, kind of piggybacking off what you were saying about how in the past throughout history, women who were more robust and curvier were seen as the height of beauty. I think a lot of that goes back to women who were of a larger size were seen as a higher class because they were able to eat more. They were able to have access to that. So I think that's a really important thing. But I also, in terms of different cultures, me being a Black woman, we have a history of putting curves on a pedestal. We like our women bigger. that's what we want. I mean, as I always joke, like, I feel like I have a flat ass, but I don't, but I have a flat ass for like a Black girl is how I feel, like for my community. And it's interesting in that growing up as a Black woman surrounded by Black women, we as a people kind of know we don't fit into the stereotype of what beauty is supposed to be, the very narrow view of that. So in a way, we had a freedom of let me dictate how this is going to go. I can dictate what's beautiful in my community because I know I'm not going to fit that community. So it doesn't matter. What we're seeing now in the present day is that a lot of the features of these marginalized communities, the curves of Black women, you know, attributes of Black women, Middle Eastern women, you know, Asian women, are seen as beautiful, but only when they're presented on a white body, which I think is kind of a weird thing.
Yeah.
So when we even saw this when, and I love this woman, but when J-Lo had that dress and everyone's like, the butt is back. J-Lo has this butt. And every Black woman's like, when did it go away? And so there's kind of an interesting thing where throughout history, marginalized communities have had to kind of dictate their own beauty. And so now it's interesting to see how our beauty is kind of being remixed in a way and sold as this is beauty, but it has to be presented in this way.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting feeling.
Yeah. You know, you bring up something that really opens my thinking a lot about this. And that is, you know, I mentioned just a moment ago how beauty standards tend to, you know, change and be in flux throughout, you know, different points in history. I would say that's probably more the case for women than men, because, you know, in those same oil paintings, you know, of these very robust women, the men all still look like The Rock. You know, they all still are very much the same, you know, sort of image. But also there's not a lot of, you know, discussion, or there's not as much discussion about beauty standards for men. You know, as a white man, I have no butt. It just goes back and then legs. You know, there's just like a flat straight line here. But, you know, at the same time, nobody's discussing that. Nobody cares about that. You know, every now and then there'll be something that becomes a part of the popular conversation, like the dad bod, you know, has been this, you know, point of conversation. But it's usually a very positive thing. Like, you know, there's been all this discussion of, oh, dad bod can be sexy. And it's like, okay, this is a very different conversation than happens around beauty standards for women. So I do think it's important to, you know, mention, you know, the way this happens across genders, but I think we also have to acknowledge women have had a women and non-binary people, non-gendered people have had a much more difficult road historically on this journey when it comes to beauty standards.
I mean, and that's because I think it just changes so much. And like you were saying with men, even now we use the term, oh, he's built like a Greek god. So like that's kind of been like that is the prototype of, oh, what male beauty is supposed to be. But it's interesting because I think women, if we're doing like a binary thing, women don't really have as much concern about a men's physique. And I think a lot of times those beauty standards are dictated by what men are into. And that changes as men typically tend to be more visual creatures. But it's interesting what you were saying about in terms of like non-binary people. I think it's interesting that we're kind of seeing a pendulum swing where, you know, in ancient times, non-binary people, it wasn't seen as anything different. It was seen as like, yeah, of course, we do have, you know, non-binary people or two-spirit people in indigenous worlds. And then with the advent of, you know, patriarchy, it became, no, men and women. And now we're seeing a swing back through that spectrum where it's like, yes, gender is a spectrum and we need to celebrate and be open to all manifestations of that spectrum. So it's interesting how it's like, it used to be fine. It was not, it was just normal. And then it became, no, it has to be that binary, you know, male and female. And I'm so happy that we're opening up those definitions of what beauty should be.
Yeah.
Especially on the gender spectrum.
Yeah. Wow. That's so, so interesting. Because you're right. You know, there are throughout almost every mythology I can think of, much broader standards of sexuality and gender and beauty than, you know, where we have landed, at least in the United States. I immediately, you know, and this again goes to my training, I immediately think of two similar mythological characters when it comes to, you know, beauty standards. And the first, of course, is, you know, Aphrodite, and the second is Oshun. And both of them, of course, are goddesses of beauty. And I believe there are such profound differences in the expression of Aphrodite and the expression of Oshun. And I'm so thankful that, you know, mythology is a broad enough spectrum to encompass a lot of different ideas when it comes to goddesses of beauty and spectrums of beauty, of course. I'm also, you know, reminded as we kind of open up this discussion, you know, of beauty standards, of one of my favorite stories from mythology, which is really about a beauty contest. And I a lot of people, you know, very well may be familiar with this story, but basically for those that are not, you've got Hera, you've got Aphrodite, and you've got Athena, and they all claim to be the most beautiful, right? They all say, no, it's me. I represent what men want. So they go to Zeus and they're like, all right, Zeus, we want you to pick from the three of us who is the most beautiful. And Zeus, being a very smart, smart god, decides, ooh, this will lead me nowhere but trouble. I am certainly, I would like to be in relationship with all three of these women, and there's no way I'm going to pick just the one. So he settles the case by having Hermes take the three goddesses to Paris of Troy and to make this big decision on who's the fairest. And throughout the story, we learn as much about men as we learn about women's beauty standards, because Paris, he decides that he's going to really draw out this contest. He's not going to just, you know, stand there and make a quick determination. And he decides he can't make up his mind. So, you know, there's kind of some differing opinions depending on which myth you are reading, depending on what happens next. But the most popular version of the story goes that the goddesses decide, well, I'm going to up the stakes. And one by one, they start shedding their clothes. And they say, well, if you can't decide, maybe if I, you know, send you some nudes, you'll be able to make a better decision here about who's the most beautiful. So all three goddesses, you know, end up completely nude, and Paris again is like, this contest is just getting better the longer I draw this thing out. So he again says, I just can't decide. All three of you look amazing. He decides, you know, he's going to try and up the ante again. And so again, the goddesses come back and they decide, well, we have to offer more. And Hera offers him power. She says, I will make you the king of Europe and Asia if you choose me. And Athena, goddess of wisdom, says, you know what? I will give you wisdom and give you great skill in war. And Aphrodite, being the woman that she is, the goddess she is, says, you know, I will offer you the world's most beautiful woman, Helen of Sparta. And this seals the deal for our friend Paris, who chooses Aphrodite. And in most versions of the myth, by the way, it should be pointed out that actually Hera was considered more beautiful than Aphrodite. But Aphrodite had such a deep understanding of men's sexuality preferences and the way that men saw sex, that she was able to often win these types of contests and win the lust and loins of men. And so, this story ends up when Paris goes to claim his prize of Helen of Sparta. This is where we get the myth, the Trojan War, as Paris goes to Sparta to retrieve Helen. So, you know, this particular beauty contest, I think, tells us a lot, because we have Hera, you know, who is this very interesting mythological figure. And we've got Athena, this very different mythological figure, you know, who's known for wisdom. And then we've got Aphrodite. And so when it comes to beauty standards, we see some nuance here, you know, that one goddess is sort of offering her mind, her intellect. One goddess is offering, you know, her wisdom. And another goddess is offering the pure carnality of, and we see which one Paris goes for. So, you know, as a woman, Tori Yates-Orr, how does this story hit you?
Every time I listen to the story, I'm like, Paris, you dumbass. Like, Hera was giving you everything. Like, you could have had the hottest woman in the world if you had all the power. Every time I hear that story. But it tells you, like you were saying, the mentality behind that. And I think it's interesting you said that Hera was seen as the more typically beautiful of the three goddesses, but Aphrodite understood how to wield that charm. And throughout history, that's kind of been the modus operandi of powerful, seen as beautiful, charming women, is that they're not typically classically beautiful. And I say that with quotation marks, but they are charming and they understand how to use beauty and all of those things as a tool. So Aphrodite was really smart in that. Paris, I don't think as much. Because look what happened, Paris.
Well, you know, and this is something we will get into more as we, you know, introduce our guest for this episode. But there's this really interesting connection between seduction and mythology, and especially, you know, the various goddesses within the Greek tradition. But actually, in many of the traditions, we see this idea of seduction and what that means. There's this connection between beauty and sexuality that, you know, probably seems obvious to a lot of people, but it really springs forth in a narrative form through many of these early myths. You know, Aphrodite is a Greek word that, or it comes from a Greek word, aphros, which means foam. And in Hesiod's version, you know, of this story in Theogony, Aphrodite is the product of white foam that was produced by the severed genitals of Uranus after his son Cronus threw them into the sea. So, you know, we say white foam to be more PG about
delicate.
This yeah, story. But really, you know, the Aphrodite is the product of the semen or seed of a man. And so there's this long-standing connection between beauty and specifically male sexuality in, you know, myths. But I think we also see and learn a lot about the way that women wield beauty in myths in particular. Contrast that to stories, you know, of Oshun and Inanna, in societies where goddesses are actually more revered than gods. Mm-hmm. In these matriarchal societies, there's less, shall we say, there's less conflict, there's less differentiation between the strong woman and the sexual woman. You know, they're sort of all wrapped up into one package, with Oshun is wise and strong and sexual, where in the Greek tradition that may be divided among three goddesses.
But yeah, I think in kind of the matriarchal religions, women are given that, not permission, but it's just assumed that yes, you'd be sexual, and yes, you'd be a great military mind, and yes, you'd be wise. They're not broken up into these pieces of self like the Greek gods are, which is interesting because I think for many people, most people, the Greek pantheon is like your introduction into mythology. And so I think we see with the men that they're a little bit more nuanced. They are a little, I mean, Zeus is all powerful and also just the worst. He's the worst. Let's put it out there. But the women are kind of, I always used to hate Hera. Even when I was a kid, I was like, oh, she's just vengeful. And that's it. She's just a wife. Right. And you see it as you get older and you're able to see the nuances in it, but the way it's presented is very narrow. And when that's the primary, you know, source, you know, as a woman, I kind of felt like I had to fit into those roles. If I had been reading about Oshun and Inanna and Ishtar when I was a kid, I'd been like, I can be all of these things.
That's a really, really important point, I feel like, in differentiating these different mythological traditions. We can see what was valued in those, you know, societies, and a singular role for women is so common in so many of these Greek myths, and it's just something to celebrate in the mythology of African mythologies and Aztec mythologies and mythologies that are not as widely read and discussed as Greco-Roman mythologies. Now, we've told a funny story about Paris. As is the tradition and ritual on our podcast, we offer a skeleton and a key on the Skeleton Keys podcast. And the skeleton from our own closets this week, you and I determined we had a plethora of skeletons to choose from. And Tori, I think you should go first here. Share with us a skeleton from your closet on this topic.
So my skeleton goes back to young middle school Tori, fun little middle school Tori. My beauty idol at the time, like so many people, was Aaliyah. I loved Aaliyah.
Good choice.
I just, everything about her, she just seemed like the coolest person. But there was a period of time where she had the ends of her hair dyed, like a light brown, light red. Mm-hmm. And I begged my mom. I was like, please, mom, let me dip dye my hair so it'll look like Aaliyah. And she's like, you're too young. I eventually wore her down. Now, the outcome of me trying to look like Aaliyah at a very awkward looking age, my hair wasn't ready for that bleach. It started to break off. So I looked like if Aaliyah's hair got stuck in like a wood chipper. But I still was like, I look like Aaliyah. I was trying to rock it. It's not great. I think my mom still has pictures. I've tried to burn them all. But that's my skeleton. Oof. I try to look like Aaliyah. Honestly, I'm still always trying to look like Aaliyah. She's still the coolest to me.
Hey, that's life goals. Life goals.
Right?
It's a good goal. It really is.
What about you?
Yeah, my skeleton also has to do with hair. I remember the first time in my adult life that like I recognized, you know, you don't just have to go to like your grandfather's barber and get, you know, a typical, very cheap, you know, buzz cut. You can actually go to these places like women go to and get your hair done. Like you can spend, you know, as a man, I could spend 2 or 3 hours at one of these places. And I remember going to this Aveda salon for the first time as a young man and going in. I had no idea what this would cost. I had no idea how this worked, but I just fell in love with the process. And, you know, they talked me into every service they offered at this Aveda salon. So I got, you know, I got my hair dyed this kind of auburn red, and they did little blonde tips, you know, at the end of it. And they, you know, washed my hair 2 or 3 times and just, you know, made a full event out of this thing. And to top it all off, the woman, you know, who spent all this time with me and provided all these services was just drop dead gorgeous. And so I, you know, thought, man, I have found my new passion in life is going to the salon. And so it came time to pay, and, you know, it was expensive, but I was like, what price can you put on the sort of joy this has brought me? So, you know, I noticed there's a spot for a tip down there. And I said, I know at a restaurant, you know, I try and tip 15, 20%. I'm going to up that. I'm going to tip like 25, 30% because this was so great. And, you know, I want to impress this woman who was, you know, doing my hair. So I started going back once a month to the salon to get my hair done and get the color redone and the tips, you know, retouch. And yeah. And every time I went, I felt this weird obligation to slightly up the tip, right? So Tori, I got to a point where eventually I was tipping at 100% of what the cost of the services were. And I couldn't find it within myself to stop, you know, tipping so much. Like, how do you go from, you know, this steady increase in tipping to back down to like 20%? Like, they're going to think you did something wrong. So the only solution I could figure out was just to stop going to the salon and start over somewhere else. Even though I loved the way this woman did my hair, I loved everything, but at some point you just got to pull the plug and decide I'm going to do better next time, but I've ruined this opportunity. So that's my skeleton for this week and my pursuit of my own beauty standards. I ended up getting myself into such a financial conundrum that I could not sustain it and had to abandon ship and start over completely at a brand new salon. That's one of 1,000 different beauty standards skeletons that exist in my closet.
How long did you go to her?
Lori, it was months.
I was like cringing. My wallet was like, gosh.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at first, again, it starts at, you know, 25, 30%. And the next time, you know, I do 35% for a little while. And then I'm like, oh, I need to make it a little more. And it goes up to 40, to 45, to 50, to 55. And eventually I'm tipping 100% of the service costs. This woman must have thought, I have reeled in the biggest catfish, you know, that exists in the beauty salon market. This guy's tipping 100% every time he comes. It was probably a very dark day for her finances when I stopped coming to that salon, actually. So
she definitely took a hit.
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure.
Wow.
Yeah. It's embarrassing, but
I don't think that's embarrassing at all, actually. I think that shows like your kindness and your heart. That's a really sweet story.
I think your reaction to it shows your kindness because I'm guessing half the people listening are like, John is an idiot. How could he do that?
See, they are wrong. As someone who knows you, I know like that's just coming out of the fact that that's your heart. And you're like, well, I have to be kind. And
yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it became about kindness. It started out with a desperate attempt to make this woman like me, you know, so, and that never happened. I mean, it's not like these mini salon trips turned into dates or anything, you know, but I believe in my time, short time there, I probably, you know, bought that woman a new car. So I'd like to think I have a special place in her heart. So
she will always remember you.
Well, it's good to end with that story because I feel like that when we talk about beauty standards, it's very complicated, I think, to look at, you know, are we trying to beautify ourselves? We would say from a biological or evolutionary perspective, we try and beautify ourselves to find a mate, to be part of the tribe, to reproduce with, to help meet and satisfy, you know, whatever needs we might have. But I think as humankind has evolved, our ideas about beauty standards have also evolved as well. And, you know, I think so often we do these things for ourselves as much as we do them for other people. I mean, I'm going to make a gross overgeneralization here about many women I've known. This is not all women, but many women I've known that I've had relationship with. I feel like over time, I begin to recognize that they were getting dressed up and getting made up as much for the other women who would be at this place we were going as they were for me or for even themselves. And again, I tread on this ground lightly. I know I am a man talking about women's beauty standards, but this is something that seems like it might happen. Am I off base here, Tori?
I don't think you're off base at all. I think most women, that is a generalization, would probably agree that we dress for other women. Let's be honest, and not that I don't like the fashion industry. It's great. However, it's a business, and it's trying to get us to purchase things. Most couture, and really, I'm kind of like, you know, a country girl, but like foo-foo shishi is what we'd call it. I'm not a man, so I cannot really relate to it. I don't think men are particularly drawn to that. I think women are more drawn to that. So when you see these women wearing these kind of outlandish clothing, it's so other women can see. Women can be like, that purse is really cute, or, you know. And it's interesting that that's the case, because I find, and this is a generalization, with men, like the simpler, the better with our clothing that we wear.
Yeah, that's pretty much 100% true, I would say.
Okay.
I think, you know, at the end of the day, this is embarrassing to say, but I think at the end of the day, that simpler the better could be also boiled down to just say the fewer clothes the better. Actually, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, I don't know that men are overly concerned with fashion, because if many straight men had a choice, we would just say, you know, hey, why even bother with clothes? Let's just see what's happening.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's also that ties back into like senses of beauty, like beauty for, not gonna say the generalization of a straight male is literally the naked body of a woman. However, for women, it's kind of what we're being shown is beauty. Like, this is what's beauty, what's on the cover of this magazine or what this star is wearing. Instead of being said, hey, your body is beautiful as is, we're being told, but you need to have this purse and this kind of lip kit or whatever those are called. It kind of goes back to like, it's more of a business to sell us what we think beauty is, more so than what maybe, you know, the rest of the world views as our actual beauty.
Well, this seems like a really good way to introduce our guest. Who do we have with us today, Tori?
We have the incomparable Aisha K. Faines. She is the creator of Women Love Power, and she uses mythological archetypes to empower women through her programs. She is a speaker, a writer, a journalist, has a degree from Yale in Near Eastern Studies and Civilizations. She is the definition of a Renaissance woman, as well as a competitive salsa dancer. There's literally nothing this woman can't do. And we are so excited to have her on Skeleton Keys. Aisha K. Faines, I'm not going to lie, I've been a fan of yours for quite some time now. Women Love Power has kind of been a touchstone for me. I actually take your assessment like every year to kind of see where I am. Can you kind of tell us what led you to create Women Love Power and to use mythological archetypes within that work?
It is such a long story. I guess I'll start with the mythology part. That is a childhood fascination. I was really interested in fairy tales when I was a kid, and I would rewrite fairy tales. And so I guess that is, to a certain extent, I was distilling even those stories into, you know, stories that could be updated. And then I think I got more into archetypes around college. And really the entry was my fascination with just fiction, because, you know, obviously screenwriters and authors and all the great novels are based on these archetypal stories. And then I went into television news, as you know, anyone familiar with my story knows. And then I came out and I was still freelancing as a journalist and really just not feeling fulfilled. And, you know, one thing led to another. And I wanted to create a platform for women that really kind of redefined what power looked like. And the archetypes, I never knew that people would be that interested in them. It was something I thought about all the time. And I had all my different ideas about archetypes and how mythological stories play out in our lives. The seduction archetypes, which a lot of people are familiar with, and that's my unique creation, came out of a conversation with my friend from college. And we were discussing feminine archetypes, and we were discussing our favorite it fascinating women. So we were having conversations about like Nina Simone and Eartha Kitt and, you know, Jackie Kennedy and Diana Ross. And I was noticing that whenever we tried to explain like what their archetypes might be, the lover archetype always came up. And I recognized that it looked differently looked different depending on what other archetypes are present in that woman's psyche. And so I started studying women and came up with this kind of grand chart and of kind of understanding how women kind of captivate in these very unique ways. So anyway, when I created the quiz, as you can tell, the quiz is a very like, you see fancy quizzes. It's not a fancy quiz. Like it is like this very rudimentary WordPress quiz, because I never knew that people would have such fascination with it. But I guess I understand now, because we tell women how to be so much. So when you kind of give women a guidepost to understanding who they really are, it's liberating.
I being a white male, when I encountered your work, I surprised myself how into your work I suddenly became. I feel like there's something really universal about what you're doing, that it not only helped me understand women, and particularly women of color, on a deeper level, but I seem to be learning something about myself. You know, did you mean to be so universal with what you were doing, or when did you notice it was so universal what you were doing?
Yes, I think naturally as a Black woman, I can't help but form some of my own personal experiences and perspectives to find their way into my work. And I even have a column where that column explores the intersection of love and Black womanhood. But for the work on Women Love Power, it was intentionally universal, because I think that when we start talking about archetypes and how feminine power is expressed, that's a message that to me has to be universal, because it has to touch every part of the globe. So that was very intentional. And even with men, actually right now I'm doing a masculine archetype course for women, but I'm really sitting here thinking about actually selling it to men too, because it's probably going to be super helpful. It's helped me, you know, because I know about the stuff before I create the course, but when you really create the course, you have to explain it, then you develop a whole new understanding. It just helped me understand masculinity in ways that inspire a little bit more grace and compassion. Even when there are things that tick me off, I kind of can understand so many things. So to answer your question, yes, it was very intentional that this be a global and universal message, and a message that women and men could at least understand, because I just think that's how we start to come to solutions.
And speaking of kind of coming to solutions, you talk obviously a lot about power, but about different kinds of power, so hard and soft power. Can you kind of explain to people what that means?
Sure. So I think that what we've come to know as power stems from what I would call like masculine consciousness, which is, you know, maybe you might call it a right brain thinking, but it's a mode of being and it's a way of interacting with the world. It's your animus, right? And it's about linear thinking. It's about logic. It's about rationality. It's about production. It's about, you know, creating a product and putting it out there. It's a little bit death-centered. It's about, you know, killing in order to advance life, allowing things to die in order to advance life. It's about legacy. Versus what I would call, you know, feminine power, which would be more connected to your anima or your left brain, you know, way of thinking, which is a more intuitive intelligence, which is, you know, emotionality, imagination, it's more creation centered and birth centered. And it's about nurturing and protecting life, counterbalance to destroying. And the reality is, we have these energies within us. Everybody does. And I think that leadership must be a balance of both forces. But what happens in patriarchies is we advance one mode of being and we suppress the other. And then we end up having grave problems, like having to wonder how we're going to get water to people, having forests that are burning, having global warming, having massive income inequality, like having these extreme issues simply because we do not have a balanced way of seeing and interacting with the world and exhibiting power.
You hit on so many things that are really at the center of what we talk about in this podcast. And, you know, we talk about mythology, history, and pop culture. And one of the things, you've brought up a lot of different names from pop culture. And, you know, when I was trained in mythology to think of things, you know, from as being either Dionysian or Apollonian, you know, and those
absolutely
being the two.
I started to say that when I said masculine power, like sort of Apollonian.
One of my friends challenged me a couple of years ago to, you know, broaden my perspective of that and had me start thinking of things in terms of Beyonce energy versus Solange energy. And it got my mind to spinning that, yes, there are so many examples in pop culture, and maybe it's, you know, Alfre Woodard energy versus Rosario Dawson energy or whatever, you know, it is. How do you see these ideas playing out in the stories, the television shows, the music, the movies that we encounter today? Do you see these examples, or do you see this type of energy being a part of the conversation in our pop culture?
Do you think masculine versus feminine energy, or just archetypal stories?
I would say both, but especially the archetypal stories. I would love to hear your answer to both, actually.
I guess I could answer both. But in terms of masculine and feminine energy, you know, the universe leans towards balance. And so we're at this point in time when we have pushed the masculine so much. Because you have to remember, patriarchy is not the history of the world, right? That's a way, it's a mode of being that's probably predominated for like 5,000 years, but it's not the world. And I think we've gotten to a place where we have become so masculine that we're becoming feminine. And so a lot of the conflicts that we're experiencing, even down to the election, like the distilled ideas of the United States election, is sort of nationalism, populist rhetoric versus diversity, and, you know, big business versus social safety nets. I mean, like all of these things are, when you distill them, it's masculine versus feminine. So a lot of the conflicts that we're experiencing right now are like holding on to things as we know them, when this like very hyper masculine way towards expanding into the realm of the feminine. The irony is that, you know, some people think that the feminine is brought on by how we interact with the world. So we've become so technologically advanced that in the 20th century, we got television and we got the cinema, and then ultimately we got the internet, which are all very visual modes of interacting and modes of communication, which I think quickened the rise of feminine energy. So it's the irony that it's the masculine technology that probably brought on this like burst of feminine energy. And that's why we live in a world now where people idolize a Beyonce, because she represents that female sovereignty. And a lot of people, I think, can of all backgrounds connect with her and figures like her. I think the end of the 20th century, we started seeing more and more of these women who surpassed singer, like Madonna, Janet Jackson, Princess Diana, actually. Even though she's not a pop star, but these women sort of just compelled into the stratosphere because they in various ways represented female sovereignty. But Beyoncé being a really, really great example of that. So nonetheless, I just think you're seeing the rise of the feminine take place. And it's the reason we're seeing so much discord. But also, I think we're definitely seeing it in popular culture and just the ways that we sort of idolize and connect to certain figures. So I guess maybe that answers both of your questions.
It does. Thank you.
Yeah.
Speaking about discord and pop culture, two kind of discussions that I saw that I think speak a lot to this masculine and feminine would be the discussion around WAP and then the discussion around the Harry Styles Vogue cover. And So he's wearing a dress. He's throughout the spread. He's in women's clothing, but is very secure in his sexuality. And there's been a lot of talk about both of these things. I was just curious what your opinion was on specifically WAP, on how so many people started talking about this when, you know, in the history of rap, and John is kind of a historian on this. Women have talked about their sexuality, but why there was this kind of uproar specifically with that song?
I think that that song is nuanced. I mean, I think one, I mean, I guess it's to connect to the rise of the feminine. I mean, women embracing their femininity on their own terms. You're right. It's not new to hip hop. That's like Salt and Pepper, Queen Latifah. But it's always, I think, provocative. I think it's one of the things, I guess. It's always going to be somebody angry if there's a woman doing somewhere being happy, doing what she wants to do. Somebody's mad. Like, so I think that's part of it. WAP is also nuanced because they're embracing their femininity, but they're also saying they're in a hoe house. And so the line of feminine power versus sexuality as a tool of capitalism is so blurred that I don't even know where it is. I don't even know where I stand. I'm just like, it's a nice video. It's a beat. I like it. And I don't even have like an opinion, because I guess it just depends on how you look at it and what perspective you want to take. That's why I think, but that's personally why I think WAP is like so controversial, because you can make the argument that this is feminine empowerment, and you can make the argument that this is a tool of patriarchal capitalism, in which women's black and particularly black women's bodies have always been commodified. So it's just a tough one. With Harry Styles, though, speaking of the Apollonian versus the Dionysian, I mean, we've been seeing an explosion of the Dionysian and the androgyne since like the 70s, like disco era. And I think that Dionysus, you know, as a figure with his maenads, has always been a liberating figure for women. So the explosion of Dionysian energy in many ways coincides with the rise of the feminine. So, I mean, to speak to that cover, even though I haven't seen it, but that's, you know.
That is a really interesting point. I like that. We did a episode last season on Snoop being sort of the modern manifestation of Dionysus. And yeah, and we even connected, you know, then maybe Martha Stewart is the modern Hestia. And, you know, we tried to put all those pieces together. I think, you know, just to kind of build on your comments, I really appreciate your unpacking, you know, of WAP as a really complicated, nuanced, you know, song and issue. And it's not something that we want everything to be this binary. It's either good or bad. And, you know, this is just not how art especially works. So I wonder, you know, because it's one of the reasons I think we can bring mythology into that discussion. And it's so helpful because you would see, you know, Aphrodite being this goddess of sensuality and sexuality. And you have these archetypes, you know, that are centered around the seduction. And I think that's another topic that people want to make a binary. Either someone, it's sort of the Madonna whore binary that is discussed so often. How do you help people begin to unpack that very complicated, nuanced issue as being more than a binary, of being really reflective of the human condition?
Yeah. I mean, the binary is man-made, you know, because even when you break down the Madonna whore, they're not two archetypes. They're two roles that were created to serve men. Like Madonna is the vehicle through which a Messiah can be born, right? And then the, you know, whore obviously is, you know, a woman who exists to serve a man's pleasure. So neither are, yes, there are Madonna figures. You know, you can argue that, you know, Isis in some ways is almost a Madonna figure, but they are not true archetypes. And so a lot of my work has centered around helping women understand how we've sort, I hate saying a false feminine, because I know for some people it is, that really is the feminine, but how femininity has been defined in ways to assist the rise and the maintenance of, you know, patriarchal societies and institutions and male domination, and how we've defined womanhood in ways that are inherently submissive. And so what some of the work that I do, particularly in my courses, is I actually start with the Greco-Roman mythology, but then I pull it out. Because the reality is the Greco-Roman mythology, they took stories that already existed, you know, in Near Eastern societies and Egyptian societies, and they gave them a real patriarchal twist. You know, Athena is, you know, our goddess of wisdom and weaving and warfare. And she's born from Zeus's head, and she helps the warriors, you know, on their way to battle. So she, her great intelligence is used in service to men, but she comes from Neith, the Egyptian goddess, and Neith gave birth to the sun god. But yet in Greco-Roman mythology, the sun god gives birth to Athena. So we've taken these stories and like we give them a real page. So one of the things that I do is I kind of help women, number one, understand these archetypes so they can understand the different expressions of the feminine and recognize that it is not Madonna or whore, which are both oppressive in their own ways. But then also to understand how even those archetypes have been influenced by patriarchy, and how if you really want to fully understand the breadth of your power and your being, you're going to have to even see those archetypes outside of a Western lens. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of like my goal in helping women get this broader, more holistic idea of what femininity is. And I want to do that for men too, you know, because the reality is a lot of the ways that we define masculinity are not just through archetypes, but through the darker aspects of the archetypes. Like we talk about Dionysian energy, the dark aspect of Dionysus is that the Maenads would claw like people they would kill. It's violence. The dark aspect of Dionysus is extreme violence. So when we see serial killers and cult leaders and Keith Raniere searing his group of women, you know, even hip hop to a certain extent, that rambunctious Dionysian energy that but then glorifies violence, like so much of the masculine is tapped into the darkness of the archetype.
Oh, that's so good. That is so good.
I mean, in speaking kind of broadening that horizon, I know for me personally, like I grew up reading about Greek mythology, but it was when I found the African mythology and the Eastern mythology, where specifically the goddesses were layered. They were less contained. They could be the mother and the sexual and the great mind and the military leader. And it was so freeing. And I think it's interesting because we know we talk about beauty norms, that there seems to be more of a wanting to learn more about those kind of archetypes that are more broad. And I think we're trying to reach a period where beauty standards are a little bit more broad. And I think connecting to that has been really helpful for a lot of people. Do you see kind of a connection with your work and with the people you work with in connecting to those broader points of view, those broader archetypes?
Do I see that people are turning to archetypes to get a broader understanding of beauty, of beauty, or I'm just
beauty and power, and kind of that of like, you can contain all of these things. You don't have to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And I think you make such an excellent point. One of the interesting things, when we talk about the Olympian goddesses, they are, I mean, and this is not with the gods. The gods can be so plentiful, but the goddesses, you basically have the queen, the mother, the they're all in relation to a central male figure. And so they're defined by their relationship to the men. And that doesn't exist. I mean, Astarte, for example, or Ishtar, and Inanna, however, you know, it's like sex and war, like this one, and hubris, and like and like all the things. Like Inanna was glamorous. She was full of herself. She had a big ego. She had multiple consorts, husband, what? No. Like the reason she got tripped up in the underworld is because she was trying to take over like somebody else's land. Like she was doing the absolute most. There was nothing like angelic about her.
I love her so much.
So I do think that it's healing for women to hear those stories and to realize that a lot of women have been trying to satisfy these boxes, which is why we get into such struggle with, it's like, how do I become a wife and a mother and a career woman? How do I make that make sense? It's hard in a world where femininity has been defined in these very strict ways. And you're feeling you're trying to reconcile multiple personalities without realizing that there's layers to you. I do think it's healing for women to hear those other stories that give them broader examples of what womanhood looks like. Because ultimately those goddesses are just reflections of how those people thought about women. It was healing for me. I mean, I love, by the way, Inanna. I feel like I am her in some ways.
I honestly, like when I first started like looking into her, I was like, oh, this is going to sound bad, but I was like, she's kind of a dick. I can be kind of a dick. Like, but she's still a goddess. Like, it resonated so much with me.
That's what I love, because it's like a lot of these gods are, Apollo is an asshole, okay?
The biggest
asshole. Pardon my French, guys. Sorry. And it's like, we don't, like, I love it when a woman has the ability to like be bad ass. Yes. And it's okay. That's very healing.
So healing. I just looked at her like, it's all right.
Yes.
Well, I have one last question for you, and then I know Tori will wrap us up with a final question. We talk about Inanna a lot on this podcast, and it's wonderful, though, to hear you talk about Inanna. I'm going to go out on a limb here, and you may have a lot to say about this, and you may have nothing to say about this, and that's okay, too. But I wonder if you are familiar with Oshun. And if you might talk about how that particular goddess is so relevant to the world that we're in right now and to our society, I believe.
Yeah, I think we're seeing more of a connection to, so I have multiple things. I think we're seeing more of a connection to Oshun in part because he has such a diverse society. You know, I'm actually a competitive salsa dancer. That's my hobby when we're not in a pandemic, because salsa is the opposite of social distancing. But literally a lot of the hand movements that the women and the body movements that the women do, it just in salsa, are evocative of Oshun. And she represents pleasure and the power of pleasure and the idea that we are a very production-oriented society. We're a very sensible society, but not a sensual society. And she represents the idea that pleasure is a vital part of a society, of creativity, of wealth building. I don't think it's a coincidence that she represents both creativity and pleasure and sex and wealth, because all these forms of abundance, I think, do stem from your ability to connect to a deeper pleasure. And obviously that's how babies are made. And there's this one myth where I think it's the god of I want to say it's Ogun, but he's the god that he goes off into a forest. And because he's in that forest, like nothing can work and no one can get him out of the forest. And she just comes and she starts laughing and dancing and bathing and just like scintillating in front of him. And he's like, all right, let me go on, get out of this and follow this woman wherever she wants me to go, which is textbook seduction, right? It's power by means of pleasure. Like so you make the person want to follow you. But I definitely think we are seeing more of that energy because that is a form, it's a very powerful form of feminine energy. And even before Beyonce, you know, obviously so powerfully brought it into the scene with, you know, her Lemonade, I think we actually would see excerpts of it. So I always think of Oshun when I see a Bond girl come out of the ocean. I think it's one of those archetypal images of like, it's Oshun. You could say it's Venus, you know, on a half shell too. But like, I think that's a, you know, or even like Chiquita Banana in the yellow. That to me is Oshun. I want to say Pam Grier, and I think the movie is Coffee. There's some one of those black boys, but she's always in gold. She's always wearing yellow. She's always wearing yellow and gold. And she's like seductive yet kick-ass, which by the way, Oshun had these lethal abilities she could kill. And so I think that was Oshun as well. So there are ways, even before Beyonce, like put it on the main stage where that archetype really kind of sprinkled itself into our society and pop culture. But I definitely think we're seeing it more because it's a powerful reminder of the power of pleasure, which is something we forget in very masculine societies.
Oh, we could literally talk to you for hours. I have so many. I know. I'm like, oh, I can actually talk about this with someone who like, oh, I love it. As for our listeners, how can they find out more about you and your work?
Sure. They can visit my website, which is womenlovepower.com. I am on Twitter and Instagram at Aisha K. Faines. I'm on YouTube at Women Love Power. And then you can also read my column in Zora magazine.
You're everywhere.
Trying to be everywhere.
Wow. This was
thank you so
amazing.
Much.
Thank you so much. This is literally my favorite interview that we've ever done. It's so, so good. It just, you know, like when you find another member of your secret society tribe out there, it's like, that's exactly what this is. It's like, oh my God, we found another member of the secret society.
Yeah, it's like one of us, one of us.
Right. I mean, seriously, I can never have these conversations with because I start going off in tangents and then you just at one point the eyes just kind of like, oh, OK, I lost you.
Well, you can always come here because me and John will be like, yes, let's talk about it.
Wow. Thank you so much for having me.
Aisha K. Faines. She is amazing. I mean, she really, really is. It's so fun to meet other members of our mythology, history, pop culture tribe that sort of speak this language and are fascinated by the things that we're interested in. What a delight to have her on the podcast.
She's the best. Her assessment, like I said, is kind of like a touchstone for me. I always take it to see where I'm at on my archetypal scale of seduction.
I love it. I love it. I learned so much. I really did. And, you know, since we've interviewed her, I've went and I've looked a lot about her work. And it is so universal. There's so much that really is beneficial and helpful, no matter who you are and what framework, you know, you're coming to life with. She's got things that apply to everyone. And I am so glad that we were able to introduce her to the Skeleton Keys audience. And speaking of the Skeleton Keys audience, I know they are waiting with bated breath for the key that we would bring. This is Skeleton Keys, and we bring you a skeleton every week. This is Skeleton Keys, and we bring you a skeleton every episode, but we also bring you a key, something that has helped us in some way, something that has been beneficial, or it may just be something that, I don't know, we've just become interested in lately. So, Tori, this episode, I would love to return to one of the classics, if you will. I believe that if we're going to talk about beauty and the wielding of beauty and the way that amazing women have wielded their beauty, always, you know, one of the stories or collections of stories that comes to mind for me is 1001 Nights. And Scheherazade is just one of my favorite mythological figures. You know, there's actually been discussion, you know, that perhaps she was someone based on a real person or someone, but regardless of if she had any sort of, you know, historical basis or not, Scheherazade is one of the greatest heroines of myth and storytelling that there is. I'm sure most people are familiar with who she is, but for those of you that are not, this king had a wife who was unfaithful to him. And he decided to avoid this ever happening again and to deal with his pain by bringing in and bedding a new virgin every night. And then the next morning, having her killed. This is a horrific part of the story. But this is what this, it's not great. It's not great. But this is what this king decided to do. And he had worked his way through just about all of the virgins in the land when Scheherazade is brought to him. And she keeps him up all night telling him this story. And she finally gets to a climactic part of the story, and the sun is beginning to rise. And the king asks, well, what happens in this story? And she says, oh, I can't finish it. The sun is up and it's time for you to kill me. And he says, well, I tell you what, I'm going to grant you another day of life because I'd really like to hear how this story ends. So the next day she finishes that story and she begins another amazing story and repeats the same process. Just when the sun is coming up, she's reached a climactic part of the story. And again, the king spares her life. This goes on for 1001 nights until over the period of time, the king actually falls in love with Scheherazade and makes Scheherazade his wife. It's just a fascinating story. There's so many nuances and layers to it. And there's a lot of different translations and analyses of this story. But that's my skeleton key for this week, 1001 Nights, and specifically focus on the character of Scheherazade.
I love that story, Scheherazade. And what's so great about that story is that what it says about beauty, too, is that kind of beauty can take you on a journey. Beauty, it can tell a story. And it kind of connects to my skeleton key. My skeleton key are two books by the late and great Kevin Aucoin. One is called Making Faces, and the other is Face Forward. And these books, my mom had them when I was younger, and I just remember being drawn to these women that he had made up. So Kevin Aucoin, his books were kind of a how-to in terms of makeup, but they were also so much more than that, and that he was obviously a man who understood archetypes and understood how powerful women throughout history and powerful, whether they're celebrities or, you know, historical figures, channeled different types of beauty. And so I remember, for instance, he had T-Boz from TLC, but he made her up as Josephine Baker. And he was so great in kind of expressing how each of these women had a very unique beauty and that each woman would have their own kind of beauty, no matter what society has told you you're supposed to look like, that you have your own story of what beauty is. And so I still go back to those books because it's using beauty as a tool to kind of showcase our individual beauty, but also how that individual beauty can tell a story. So it kind of connects to Scheherazade in that way. I wasn't expecting it to, but it did. And so those two books will be my skeleton keys.
Oh, that is so, so good. I have never picked up either of those books, although I've heard about them from a number of people. So I think you've inspired me to go and pick those up because, again, I'm amazed how much of this type of material, to use a trite metaphor, it's more than skin deep. You know, it really does go beyond the way that we adorn our bodies or the way that we make up our bodies. We're speaking to a larger psychological issue. And I feel like we would be, you know, remiss if we didn't, you know, bring up a couple of key things that we can just chat about briefly here before we wrap things up, Tori. I think, you know, we've spoken a bit about race issues and beauty standards. I think that, again, we could do full episodes just about that particular issue. But also, we've spoken briefly, but not nearly enough, about size and weight issues and beauty standards. And we certainly have been in a era where thin is in, and, you know, more full-bodied individuals have gotten the short end of the stick in beauty standards. And then also age issues. We, I think, still live in an era where young is beautiful, and the older people get, the less beautiful they become. So any thoughts pop into your head just, you know, on those three topics?
You know, and speaking of age, I find that is very much gendered. That I think men are considered to get better with age. Yeah. I know, you know, I mean, like a George Clooney, when men start getting that salt and pepper, it's seen as like, oh, they're distinguished, they're attractive. I mean, women, we're seen as just put them out to pasture, like they're done. My birthday is coming up, not by the time we release this, but by the time it'll be coming up. And I really had to think, and I was like, maybe I won't tell my age. And I was like, who am I trying to impress? Like, who cares? Like, I'm about to be 34, and I'm proud of it. It's a lot better than the alternative. But it's that internalized sense of like, but young is better. And that's internalized in me, where I even myself was like, well, I don't want to say my age.
Yeah.
And that's something that especially in Western society, we exalt youth. I think in other societies, we have a lot more respect for and love for people who are older. I even remember being in France and being like, oh, the women here who were older were just gray hair, gorgeous, were embracing it, and weren't trying to look like younger versions of themselves.
Yeah.
And they just look so like, yeah, of course I've got long gray hair. And especially, you know, with a United States focus, we don't want to see that. So I think it's very much an internalized thing and something that we have to keep pushing up against. I mean, I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah.
But that's just my two cents.
I think you're 100% right. And, you know, I've noticed, you know, it's hard to even pull the age thing out from issues of race and weight and, you know, size, because I think, you know, there are some, well, for example, I think of your dear mother, Vicky Yates. Beautiful, beautiful woman who I would never dare to guess her age, but I am sure she's been mistaken for your sister a time or three.
She has.
Yeah, because again, she, you know, has maintained a great beauty, you know, throughout her life and through her age. And then some individuals, you know, I don't know if they live hard lives, you know, but we find out, wow, that person really, you know, is looking old. And it's like, yeah, they're 26, you know, they've just had a hard life.
Well, that could also intersect with like class. Like a lot of times, you know, you might not have access to extraneous beauty treatments that you might be able to take. So maybe that 26 doesn't have access. I've had Botox, doesn't have access to Botox, or, you know, so there's they're so interconnected. But I completely agree. I've seen some people where I'm like, oh, you're that age? Okay.
No. You know, the other thing it reminds me of, two different times in my life, I've really had my ideas about beauty standards rattled, and they've both been visiting other countries. I remember I was fortunate enough to spend some time in Cuba, and I was spending some time with some men my age who were Cuban men. And in this particular part of Cuba, I'm not trying to make a generalization about all of Cuba or all of Cuban men, but in this particular village where I was with these particular men, this woman came through who had clearly spent her life working in the sun and was very, very dark skinned. And all of them sort of leaned over and said, "That is a woman."
Yes.
And I inquired, you know, of them, and it became very clear, you know, with this group of men, the darker the woman, and actually even she was a little older, you know, than they were. But this for them was the height of beauty. This really was what they desired. I'm also reminded of, a time I was in Burkina Faso, and the particular group of men I was with, they were all trying to get a look at these women's calves. And the women we were around were either mostly topless or close to, you know, topless, and they could not have cared less. But, you know, all these women had skirts that went down to their ankles, and they were all just dying to get a look at these women's calves. And again, in this with this particular group of people, that was what was beautiful, you know, to them. And that was what was attractive. And certainly there are, you know, obviously, you know, the breasts, the buttocks, these things are in
programmed.
Many, if not most cultures, programmed, yeah, to be. But I think it also goes to show there's a nature versus nurture thing happening where certain ideas about beauty standards are specific to specific cultures. And we don't, just because we have those in our particular culture or community doesn't mean it's the case all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. I think when we realize that that's the story of beauty is different everywhere, it just kind of, it takes the pressure off you. It can. It really can. Of like, okay, what is my beauty story? What is that? What does that mean to me? Because it might mean something different in so many different places.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of beauty, I have to go and tweeze my brows and go get my beauty rest. So we're going to have to wrap this up. But Tori, I know people are out there dying to share their own ideas about beauty standards with us. Where can people get a hold of us?
You can always shoot us an email at skeletonkeyspodcast@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on the socials. You can DM us, leave us a message, whatever you'd like. It's at skeletonkeyspod on Twitter and Instagram. And then you can also follow us on our personal social medias. I'm Tori Yatesor, TORRIYATESORR, on Instagram and Twitter.
And I'm John KBUCHER on Twitter and Telling a Better Story on Instagram. Remember this, even if nobody else in the world tells you this today, you are beautiful. And we'll see you next time on Skeleton Keys.
Bye, beauties.
You've been listening to the Skeleton Keys podcast with Tori Yates-Orr and John Booker. A podcast that unlocks the mysteries of mythology and history in pop culture. Contact us at skeletonkeyspodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram and Twitter @skeletonkeyspod. Skeleton Keys is a production of Sideshow Media Group.